From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Jamie Sycamore. He's a candidate for the D.C. Council. He's an independent and he's running in the Ward 1 district of the city. But joining us in studio now is Dirk Hare. He is chairman of the Maryland Republican Party. Dirk Hare, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know Tom Sherwood. He's our resident analyst and a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, good to see you.
Hello.
Before we get specifically to Dirk Hare, Tom Sherwood, Virginia Democrats trying to run to outraise Republicans for the quarter in House races. All four Democrats who are running in competitive races seem to be outraising the Republicans in terms of money. Virginia is already considered a purple, almost blue state at this point. But what else does this signify?
Well, it just shows how aggressive the state party in Virginia has been coming off of its big wins back in 2017 when they nearly took over the House side of the state legislature. But, you know, one of the problems I think has been a drag on the race has been Corey Stewart, who has not been able to get the traditional Republican leadership of the state to do more than marginally endorse him. Tim Kaine, with all his national exposure as Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, has raised $20 million. Corey Stewart has raised barely two.
Just got a million.
Well, in the last 3 months or so, yes, but it's a little bit late because he hardly has time to spend it.
It's never
but
too
in
late
those house
Corey,
races,
as far as Corey is concerned.
In the House races, in the 10th, the 7th, and the 5th districts, all of which I won't go through all the candidates now, but all the Democrats are raising substantial amounts of money and have money on hand to close as strong as far as money goes. The question is whether or not the Republicans, they contend that they're with the Kavanaugh hearing and all of that, that they've seen a boost in their enthusiasm that wasn't there. A very exciting time for the last 3 weeks.
The race that in this area that a lot of people are obviously looking at is incumbent Barbara Comstock, Republican, being challenged by Democrat Jennifer Wexton at this point. And Jennifer Wexton has been outraising Barbara Comstock. We'll have to see what happens there. And Dirk, I don't know how close you've been watching what's been going on in the Montgomery County executive race, but Mark Eldridge has been endorsed by a real estate group. Tom Sherwood, why is that even significant?
Well, because Nancy Florine, the Democrat who was going to retire but decided she didn't want to see Mark Eldridge become the county executive, switched to independent solely for the purpose of this race, contends that he's anti-business, anti-development. Of course, Mark Eldridge denies that and says that he just wants developers to be more sensitive to road and infrastructure issues that are come along with their development. But he did get the endorsement of the Greater Capital Area Association of Realtors, which is a fairly large group, and it helps blunt the image that maybe Mark Eldridge is not business friendly. So we'll see. They endorsed back in the primary, I think, Bill Frisk, the state delegate, who came in last in that campaign. So I don't know how powerful they will be, but it's an added wrinkle for Mark Eldridge, who's trying to be the Democratic county executive to replace Ike Leggett.
And Dirk Hare, the Republican Party candidate in that race, is Robin Ficker. He is trailing in the polls, of course.
Perfect segue.
He's trailing in the polls behind the other two candidates at this point. What are you looking at in this race?
I mean, it's an unusual dynamic. Somewhat ironically, I ran into a Montgomery County businessman. My office is at 15th and L yesterday at my regular Starbucks, and he was picking my brain on this very topic. He was someone who's a Democrat who is very much on the Nancy Florine side of things and was kind of teeth gnashing and wondering what was going to happen. I don't have really any good insight into what's going to happen in Montgomery County, but I do want to draw an interesting parallel with Montgomery County Executive to Baltimore County Executive, because there was a similar dynamic that played out in the primary in Baltimore County where the most progressive of the three candidates won. And our polling right now shows that Al Redmer, who was the more moderate of the two Republican candidates, has a solid polling lead. So I think, you know, it if I draw any conclusions from both of those county exec races on the Democratic side, it's that the progressives, for whatever this means, ultimately seem to be getting the better side of what you might term as the mainstream Democratic Party.
In case you're just joining us, that is Dirk Heer. He is chairman of the Maryland Republican Party. Would you like to begin, Tom Sherwood?
Well, we can't let Robin Ficker go this quickly. His issues, whether it's term limits or tax restrictions, have been very popular in Montgomery County. But he has had trouble with his maybe his personality, aggressiveness. Cocho and I did a recent debate in Montgomery County with Montgomery Cable. Governor Hogan, who has been running a very strong campaign across the state and including Montgomery County, has not really shown up with Robin Ficker. Have you not arranged a proper campaign event as the chairman of the party?
I mean, as the chairman of the Republican Party, I support very actively all of our candidates, and I think Robin is a fine candidate. And you know, I'm very hopeful that he's going to shock a lot of folks on Election Day. As I think you're probably pretty aware, both state parties have limited resources, and where we've really focused is on the state senate in Maryland, for the simple reason that we see that as a path to get Governor Hogan a veto-proof General
right.
Assembly.
That's the big, if you have a boxing card, it would be the second item on the card beyond the governor's race. It's the Republican Party's effort across the state to win at least 5 Senate races in order to give the governor some support in the Senate, at least. You were saying just before the show you thought you were pretty good positioned to win those 5 seats.
What are the seats you're focused on?
Well, we actually, our polling keeps expanding the map. We're now polling this week in 12 Senate districts, and our polling right now is showing that we have a potential path to victory in as many as 10 of those
seats. Is there a total number of Senate seats in the?
There are 47 Senate seats 47. In the General Assembly, and there are 14 Republicans currently. We need 19 in order to.
If the governor's veto power was guaranteed, if you do win those 5 seats, that would presumably change the calculus as to how he governs. What might be on your party's agenda that would not be able to pass without a veto-proof majority in the state legislature?
I've known Governor Hogan for 20 years, and I haven't found him to be a person who changes a whole lot. So I think what you probably would see in his second term is a more, you know, successful focus on business issues and reducing regulation. I think there might be a push to lower taxes in a way that he hasn't been able to with the current makeup of the legislature.
The good news for Governor Hogan is that in the most virtually every poll, but certainly the last 5 polls that have come out statewide, all have him in the range of 20% above Ben Jealous, outraising Ben Jealous with fundraising, support in the polls, surprising to some strength in Montgomery County. Is there a concern at all that Ben Jealous is telling reporters that he expects a blue wave that will bring the Democrats home and independents into the campaign it's not being reflected in the polling? And he reminds us all that back in June, he won the Democratic, hard-fought Democratic primary contest, where he was seen as neck and neck with Rashern Baker. He won by 10 percentage points, so a dramatic change. Is there concerns that the Republicans may be too confident about Larry Hogan?
I've always been concerned about everything as a Republican in Maryland. Let me give you a few data points that, you know, we're focused on. So I think you probably saw yesterday the Jealous camp floated out the number 57%. They said they need 57% turnout. Well, what's interesting about that is if you look in the last 6 elections in Maryland, the Democrat percent of turnout has been a high of 57.3% in 2010. Notably, the second highest Democrat turnout in that time period was 2002, when it was 57.1%, and Governor Ehrlich won that year. So, you know, we have been baking into our polling about a 3% higher Democrat turnout, just so that we can anticipate that wave.
Mm-hmm. And just about that wave, if Ben Jealous's campaign will say they expect 57% Democrats, well, that's only in 2014, Hogan beat Anthony Brown. It was 54%. So while 3% is larger than it sounds when you say it, it still doesn't sound like a blue wave. It sounds like a blue ripple.
Well, how about the Democrats saying that, look, we've been seeing more Democrats applying for absentee ballots than Republicans have, so that gives us a signal that there is likely to be a blue wave. What do you think about the absentee ballot count?
So the absentee ballot looks to be performing exactly the same as 2010. As of yesterday, there were 113,000 ballots that had been requested. 24,000 had actually been returned. Republican percentage of that as of yesterday was running about 1.5% below the return pace of 2010, and it was running about 2 points higher than 2014. So, you know, the numbers don't look substantial. We see about 1,900 of the votes that have been returned would be folks that we would have termed that not in our likely voter category. So out of, 1.8 million votes, if that's what we see, that's not a huge number.
I want to ask you about the tone of the campaign, because I was, of course, doing research on your appearance here today. And back in May, you were the keynote speaker for the Lincoln-Reagan Washington County gathering. And in talking about the Attorney General campaign, Brian Frosch, the Democrat, Craig Wolf is a Republican nominee who's working pretty hard in his campaign. He's not nearly as well known. But you said in that speech of Brian Frosch that, quote, he personified evil. And now the story I read didn't go into what you said after that, but Brian Frosch personifies evil?
So the analogy I was making, right before I said that, actually, I gave a very supportive comment to Democratic Party State Chair Kathleen Matthews. The point I was making is, and this comes from my direct experience with Brian Frosch's office, where I have seen them intentionally do politically motivated and improper things. And I was making the point that, not all Democrats are like Brian Frosch, and my interactions with Kathleen Matthews have been entirely cordial. I've found her to be nothing but polite, and I was just merely drawing the case that I think Brian Frosch is just about the most disreputable Democrat in the state of Maryland.
Is there on your website or something where we could see what these unethical or whatever these, I'm sorry, I lost the word you used, somewhere he has done something specifically that you think is improper, illegal, or unethical? Is there one item you can name so we'll have
You may remember in the Washington Post about a year ago, there was a baseless ethics complaint filed against Governor Hogan's campaign. And I thought that the response that the Attorney General's office gave on that was politically motivated, improper. And frankly, if you were reviewing my record, you may have seen that 2 weeks ago in the Annapolis Capitol, I called for an end to the tit-for-tat ethics complaints on both sides. And my point here is we need to stop it. It needs to stop. And Brian Frosch is not the type of person, not the type of politician who's going to stop this tit-for-tat. And I think he needs to be called out on it.
Our guest is Dirk Hare. He is chairman of the Maryland Republican Party. Governor Hogan has walked a fine line when it comes to President Trump, distancing himself from many of the president's less popular policies and statements while not distancing himself entirely from the broader GOP message. What does the governor's complicated relationship to the Republican president say to you about where Republicans in general are at politically in this election season in Maryland?
I don't think the governor has a complicated relationship with the president. I think he has no relationship with the president. and really, I don't know, that it's not showing up as having any impact in our polling, neither in the governor's race nor in our targeted general assembly races.
I've said that Governor Hogan has wrapped himself in political bubble wrap when it comes to President Trump. Although you did say in that same Washington County speech that Trump is dialed into a part of America that has been forgotten. So there are some positive aspects of the Trump feeling, but you don't think that's going to be significant in this statewide race?
Well, I think you have to separate Trump the person from Trump policies. I think they're two very different things. In a county like Montgomery, the Trump the person creates a lot of anger and reaction, and I think because of the nature of Montgomery County and its electorate, that has more of an effect from an electoral standpoint. I think when you get, you know, not even out to Western Maryland or the lower shore, but even into Anne Arundel County or Baltimore County, you have a sizable amount of the electorate that isn't particularly fond of the president's tweeting, but they're perfectly happy with the performance of the economy. And then when they look closer at home and they see what a terrific job Governor Hogan is doing, I think, you know, it makes it very easy for us to
Well, let's leave Trump aside. The 6th district, the seat that John Delaney used to have, David Trone, the Democrat, now up to $30 million for his last two races to run for Congress. Amy Hober, is that how she's?
Ami.
Oh, I knew I'd get one of them wrong. She herself, her husband has raised a great deal of independent money for her. A lot of money being spent in that race. Where do you see it?
I mean, we just actually got some polling back on that race a couple days ago that shows it's within the margin of error with about 20% undecided at this point. I think Ami is in position to win that race. I mean, no one thought that Dan Bongino back in 2014 could defeat.
We miss Dan Bongino and his low-key attitude. He's become like a radio guy in Florida or something like now.
Yeah, Ami and Dan.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't get off on Mr. Bongino.
For those who don't know who he is, the low-key was sarcastic, but go ahead, please.
So, I mean, we're very excited about Ami and the position she's in.
Is there, do you think there's anything about the, and while there is a great deal of money that she has from independent PACs, that Mr. Trone's spending so much of his personal money is a factor in the campaign, or is that just the way American politics is?
So the factor I would say that we're most, that's most noticeable in that race is he seems to be putting a lot of money into a field operation in Congressional District 6 that we're not seeing anywhere else in the state of Maryland from the Democrats. And, you know, what the impact of that will be is yet to be determined, but that is the most noticeable thing I've seen beyond, obviously, his saturation of the radio and TV airwaves.
Here's Alfonso in Silver Spring. Alfonso, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well.
Can you hear me?
We hear you very clearly.
Okay, great. Three quick things. The comments about Brian Frosch couldn't have been more absurd and were left unchallenged. So as a resident of Montgomery County, when Brian Frosch was in the state legislature, we all know him to be nothing but upstanding and absolutely ethical, which is why he's going to win re-election quite easily. So I would have appreciated a challenge to those really absurd comments. And your guest calling him evil is just a great example of how the governor may have stepped away from Republican national politics, but the Republican Party in the state of Maryland has not.
Second point.
Is really... What's that?
Second point, you said you had 3 points to make.
Yes, yes. Second point, very quickly, is that Governor Hogan poses a really fascinating challenge to the Trump model of politics in that I don't think Montgomery County Democrats vote for him because they believe in his policies, having discussed this with lots of them. They vote for him because he has channeled himself as simply a very nice nonpartisan guy. And this is an uncomfortable thing to acknowledge, but his illness and his recovery from his illness has been used quite effectively in his campaign,
third point.
You know, from his ads. Third point very quickly is I wonder why Governor Hogan doesn't try to separate himself more from the party itself and consider running as an independent. I'm a diehard liberal.
Jamie Sycamore would absolutely love that. So allow me to have him respond.
There's nothing really to comment on there.
Well, you know, Hogan has been across the country, has been pointed out to be an ideal Republican who has not gotten drawn into the presidential politics one way or the other.
Who's not been drawn into the vicious partisanship that we're experiencing.
I completely agree. I think Governor Hogan is...
But on that, he called attention again to your mentioning of personified evil. Do you think that was maybe over the top? Evil?
Politics sometimes is over the top.
Okay. What do you feel about beer? We have an anonymous comment on our website. What's the Maryland GOP's position on craft beer versus international macro brewery companies? Is this something you spent a good...
Peter Franchot called that in.
The party doesn't have a position on I'm aware that there is that's an issue in the legislature, but we don't really offer our opinion on that.
Peter Franchot has tried to, the presumably Democratic state controller has has wanted to do something about the tight control of that by the brewing industry. But can we talk about the Andy Harris?
Well, one more question about Governor Hogan, because some say that the governor's plans for increasing traffic on Interstates 495 and 270 and the Baltimore-Washington Parkway is short-sighted in light of the imminent threat of climate change and the fact that people are using increasingly different methods of transportation than cars, and that they need, because of climate change, to be discouraged from using cars. What say you and the party?
I think that a sizable majority of even Montgomery County residents would be very excited about having traffic reduced so that they can get their kids to practice after school, so they can get their children to dance lessons. And I think that, you know, it's a common sense, very sensible approach to a problem that faces nearly everyone.
But it does seem to be somewhat controversial. And what does it say about the notion of how we plan for the long-term future, given climate change?
So you've described it as controversial. I don't think it's that controversial. And I think we've seen in the case of Virginia where, you know, some of their traffic measures have started to improve traffic flow in the region. And I think that's what Governor Hogan's trying to accomplish.
May we ask, what part of the state do you live?
I live in Edgewater, near Annapolis.
Okay, good. Andy Harris is the long-sitting Republican member of the House in Maryland. He's being challenged by Jesse Colvin, I think is how you pronounce his last name, who's put up a pretty good campaign, surprisingly to some people. He's actually been engaged. He's fairly new to the first district there on the eastern shore of Maryland. What's your thoughts about that? A lot of people in D.C. don't like Andy Harris because he gets involved in city issues like marijuana. But in the state of Maryland, what's that race look like to you as the head of the state party?
I think that Jesse Colvin's going to spend a lot of money to lose very badly.
Why do you think he's going to lose very badly?
Because our polling has Congressman Harris up 26 points.
Here is Angela in Silver Spring. Angela, your turn.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to figure out who I'm going to vote for governor, but a big problem with Governor Hogan is his stance on choice and the fact that it's even a political issue. I mean, it needs to not even be a political issue. It needs to just be a medical procedure, and the laws need to get off our bodies. And that's a problem for me with Governor Hogan, and I just want to put that out there.
What is Governor Hogan's position on abortion or right to choose?
I don't know what his position is, but I know he has
stated. Maybe the caller might know.
Yeah, he's stated. I mean, as far as I know, I think there's a constitutional amendment in the state of Maryland currently that protects a woman's right to an abortion. So that.
What is your understanding of the governor's position, Angela?
That it's, you know, like don't ask, don't tell. He's not going to get involved, but he wouldn't protect it.
Care to respond to that, Jamie?
Well,
I mean, I'm not sure where it is.
Who's here?
I think the state of the law would require a constitutional amendment to do what the
speaking of constitutional amendments, there is one to establish same-day voter registration in Maryland. It's on the ballot this year. Where do you and the party stand on that?
We obviously want to encourage voting in all forms. I hope that the state's going to be able to administer that a couple things. I talked to the State Board of Elections quite a bit, and of course they've got concerns about how to implement it just from a technology standpoint. So they're working on that. I have confidence in the State Board of Elections. They've done a fabulous job. I think they'll get it done. I will also note that as all of these new ways to vote have increasingly been put into place, it hasn't had an effect one way or the other on actual voter.
Well, a lot of jurisdictions have same-day registration. You sign up and you vote, and then your ballot is held before they check it.
I understand it, they're going to allow you to vote as long as it clears the voter book. If it doesn't, then you would vote provisionally as you would if there were any other potential anomaly with the poll book.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to Maryland's partisan gerrymandering case, where the lines of the 6th Congressional District were drawn by Democrats to make that district safer for them. The state's lines will be redrawn in 2021 after the 2020 census data is collected. How would you want to see the process of redistricting change in Maryland?
Well, I think the governor has put forth, at least in the last three General Assembly sessions, a bipartisan, nonpartisan redistricting commission. I think the governor's proposals make good sense. I guess we'll see what happens after the governor's reelected.
This is maybe a self-serving question for the journalism world, but Bruce DuPoit, who's a reporter in Maryland, you probably know Bruce, he wants me to ask you, do you approve of the president's speech in Montana this week in which the president cheered physical violence against a reporter?
I'm not familiar with those remarks.
Well, I was just listening to that story earlier. It had to do with an incumbent member of Congress who pushed a reporter who had been asking him questions, and the president at a rally there said he is
charged with assault and apologized.
Yes, he's my kind of guy, and there was a great deal of applause there. But here's this question from Caitlin. I guess this comes from the Dirk Here Hope category. Do you think that Mark Elrich and Nancy Florine might split the vote, which could pave the way for Robin Ficker becoming Montgomery County executive?
It's politics. Anything's possible. Governor Hogan's going to do well in Montgomery County. I think a lot would depend on what kind of coattails that Governor Hogan has in Montgomery County.
As to whether Robin Ficker...
If the Democrats, and there's, I think some of the air has gone out of the balloon across the country that the Democrats are going to sweep to major victories, either in the Senate or the House. But if the Democrats were to win back the House, Elijah Cummings, veteran Democratic member of Congress, would be in charge of the committee that would oversee a lot of things that the president does. And one of the things he's talked about specifically this past week is President Trump's interference with the FBI headquarters move possibly to Maryland. This is both a political and a economic issue. 11,000 jobs, direct jobs from the FBI in suburban Maryland, and plus all the attendant jobs that come with to support it. Do you have any thoughts about the effect of President Trump's decision on the FBI affecting your party in Maryland? I know the governor would like to have the FBI in Prince George's County.
I don't see how that would have any practical effect electorally. I think if the FBI needs a new headquarters, it would be terrific if they would locate it in Maryland and provide new jobs for the state of Maryland.
The new reporting is that President Trump, with his hotel across the street, personally intervened and stopped it.
And I have no personal knowledge of any of that, so okay. I don't.
It's clear that the Maryland Republican Party, like Governor Hogan, is placing a lot of distance between itself and President Trump. And as Dirk here said earlier, he thinks people make a distinction between President Trump, the individual, and what they see as President Trump, the phenomenon. Before you go, you know this before, we've been having a very difficult time getting Governor Hogan to join us on this broadcast, despite the fact that he told one Tom Sherwood that he would come on, and we are having his opponent Ben Jealous on next week. What can you do to help us bring the governor here?
I will do my very best to have him find a time in his schedule. Obviously, as the race is finishing up here, the governor's trying to be out and about and connecting with Marylanders all across the state.
Dirk here is chairman of the Maryland Republican Party. Governor Hogan, please take Dirk's calls. Dirk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next is Jamie Sycamore. He's a candidate for the D.C. Council. He's an independent running in Ward 1. And Tom Sherwood, the D.C. Council, has, I guess, rubber-stamped its initial vote to repeal Initiative 77. And so with a second vote, again, 8-5, Initiative 77, which would have raised the pay of tipped workers in the city, is now essentially repealed.
Right, and they voted a second time to make it an emergency bill, so it passed, so it's in effect right away, and so that bill is toast.
I tell you something that I find fascinating. It seems to me that what's going on in Montgomery County between Nancy Florine and Mark Elrich, the Democrat, is really comparable to what's going on in the district's at-large race between Dion Reeder and Alyssa Silverman. Nancy Florine has decided to leave the Democratic Party, at least temporarily, and become an independent to oppose Mark Elrich because she believes he's too far to the left and might be, in some respects, in her view, anti-business. In the District of Columbia, Dion Reeder is challenging Alyssa Silverman, has left the Democratic Party and decided to become an independent because, in her opinion, Alyssa Silverman is too far to the left and might be helping to foster an anti-business climate in the city. The big difference between those two races is race. And it seems to me that progressives...
Race and religion, if you don't want to look at
that's it. That's true. It seems to me that progressive and liberal whites in the district are really outraged that Alyssa Silverman could be opposed by someone who is seeking the support of the African-American community because they feel they have always tended to side with people who are especially low income and in need of government assistance in the African-American community, and that it makes it appear to them as if the African-American community is siding with the business community because Dion Reeder has received so much support from businesses in the District of Columbia, which of course include the developers who a lot of people blame with causing the kind of gentrification that's happening in the city.
Well, that's a lot to unpack, but I'll try.
I don't usually say that.
The key
much,
difference between the two races is that Nancy Florine was retiring from politics and got into the race as an independent in Montgomery County solely to defeat Mark Elrich, who she thinks is just wrong on too many issues, particularly around development. Dion Reeder got into the race at large race in the summer of 2017. She didn't make some last minute decision to get in. She wanted to run as an independent, and she wanted to run because she didn't like the paid family leave bill that Alyssa Silverman did. And that wasn't a lot of racial aspect of that, if any. The concern has been that some of the supporters of Dion have made it much more of an African-American thing, that we ought to have not only an African-American woman, but a gay African-American woman on the force. And then there are some people around the Dion Reeder campaign, and she's been cautioned about this. She knows what I'm talking about. Is some strains of anti-Semitism, of a criticism of Alyssa Silverman that she somehow is separate from, not a person of faith. Just this very week, Alyssa Silverman was talking to the council members and said, "I am a person of a faith." And she has said in the past that when people say person of faith, it sounds like you're talking about Christians. So there are some undercurrents, and maybe our next guest can address what he's seen in the community about whether or not the complaints against Alyssa Silverman are solely because of policy differences or some cultural differences. We do know Mayor Bowser has jumped in whole hog. She had a fundraising party for Dion Reeder this past weekend. But the mayor has personally just does not like Alyssa Silverman, and that's driving her opposition to Alyssa Silverman. I do not think it's race on the mayor's part. But within the Dion Reeder campaign, there are people who are making it a racial issue.
Our guest is Jamie Sycamore. He's a candidate for D.C. Council. He's an independent running for Ward 1. Jamie Sycamore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
What are the observations about the observations that Tom and I were just making?
Yeah, welcome to the show, Jamie.
As you say, Tom, this is the politics hour, right?
Yep.
So,
Where are you on that race, incidentally? Before you give us your philosophical response, are you supporting either Alyssa or Dion?
You know, there's a lot going on in this race. I'm so hyper-focused on my own race.
Okay. You're out in the campaign. You've heard everything I just said in terms of the committee. What do you think about the tenor and tone of this campaign between Dion and Alyssa, whether you like one or the other?
You know, that's a great question. I love them both. I think that's more of a philosophical thing. I don't think there's a race issue. I've worked with Miss Silverman before. I've met Miss Reeder on the campaign trail. I think they're both fantastic people. I'm looking forward to working with either one of them or both of them.
Now let's talk about your view about changing from Democrat to independent. You were running in the Democratic primary, but you dropped out and changed your voter registration to independent. Mm-hmm. You then re-entered the race as an independent. This is not uncommon in the district where crowded primaries mean a tougher road to the nomination. Is that why you took that road?
Partly. I saw that the race was incredibly packed during the Democratic primary. In order for us to really unseat a sitting council member, we need to have more of a one-on-one race. So I made that decision to drop out because of that reason. And it was really hard for me because I'm a lifelong Democrat. I've always been part of the Democratic Party, so it was really hard for me. But coming into the independent realm is actually really suited me because now I can start making decisions based on what's best for my ward, not what's best for the party or for the party of my mayor.
You mean, wait a minute, you mean if you'd stayed a Democrat, you'd make decisions based on what was best for your party over the best for the city?
No, but I feel like
that's what
it
sounded like.
No, it's more that that Democratic Party pressure to follow the status quo. And I'm really happy to be breaking away from that.
Okay. A lot of people don't know you. This is a chance to talk to people. You're 30 years old, is that right?
31.
31. Mm-hmm. Yes, time flies. You're a professional sign language interpreter?
Correct.
How did you get into that business?
Started when he was 13 years old.
I was about
13. Is there a family member?
I've been around a long time.
Hearing impaired?
Yep. So I was born and raised in Rochester, New York, which is close to the Rochester Institute of Technology, which has a huge deaf population called NTID, National Technical Institute for the Deaf. It's where I fell in love with a deaf boy, and he told me that my sign language was terrible. So that really gave me that motivation.
So you had an ulterior motive.
Exactly. And, you know, I went to school for musical theater and things like that, and it wasn't suiting me. I dropped out, and I was really contemplating what to do with my life. And one of my friends who is deaf told me, you know, you're really good at this. You should become an interpreter. And I was like, no. I have too many things to say. I don't want to actually interpret. But it really has become such a great career choice for me. I've been to places I never thought I'd be.
So are you an independent? Are you hired on a
freelance
contract
basis?
Yep. Freelance basis.
Correct.
For an event?
Yep.
Like you would do it here if we were.
Correct. And I wish we could have worked that out today. Unfortunately, we couldn't work out the interpreter today.
Okay. You told the Washington City paper that though you yourself are not deaf, you want to be, quoting here, the vessel to provide direct access and communication with the deaf community. What do you see as the needs that of the city's deaf community that you don't think are currently being addressed or met?
And how big is that community?
In Ward 1, it's not that large, but in D.C. in general, it's quite large because it's an attraction from Gallaudet University and federal government hiring priorities, which is fantastic. But the idea of providing direct communication and constituent services, even to people who aren't in your ward, is really valuable. That's why Gallaudet University was established, because we wanted to make sure that we provided direct access to students and from teachers without that loss of interpretation, possibly that could have happened through interpreters.
Our guest is Jamie Sycamore. He's a candidate for the D.C. Council running in Ward 1 to unseat incumbent Brianne Nadeau. He is an independent. Brianne Nadeau is a Democrat.
Okay, we're just a couple of weeks from this election. Let's be as hardcore politics hour as possible. You're challenging Brianne Nadeau. Why? She's running for a second term. She defeated
Jim Graham,
who has since passed, accusing him of ethics of violations that undermined his ability to work well in the ward. She's now running for re-election. You say you're opposing her. What are the major reasons why?
The biggest reason is absolutely constituent services and responsiveness. It's being out in the community. It's about showing your face. It's not about a photo opportunity anymore. We have to be out in the community.
And she's not?
She is not.
She says, of course, she is. I talked to her today, this week, when she said, are you coming on this show? And she said, you know, she does constituent service, and there's any elements to that you can cite?
Having one Brianne on your block a month isn't enough. People appreciate you going out to their community events. The two things that I hear constantly from constituents is she's absent and unresponsive. If there's something that she doesn't like, she'll push it aside. She doesn't really like to deal with the hard issues of Ward 1, and there's a lot of conflicting interests in Ward 1, and that's something something that you really have to deal with as a council member. We're the most diverse ward in the city.
Okay, then what are the hard issues in Ward 1 that where you disagree with Brianne Nadeau?
A lot of it has to do with equity. I've noticed that there's a lot more attention being paid to the western part of the ward, which has Adams Morgan and Mount Pleasant, as opposed to the eastern side of the ward, which has Parkview and some of the lower income residents who live there.
What would be your top three priorities if you were elected to the council?
So number one is affordable housing and affordable living, making sure that we develop for the communities we have, not just the communities we want to bring in.
I don't think you will find any of the 13 elected members of the D.C. Council at this point who would not say exactly the same thing. Why? How would you be different?
So it's affordable living that makes me different. It's we can build all the affordable housing that we want, but if we don't have affordable food options, that's going to be really impacting our residents. So at the 965 Florida Avenue project, I believe it's called the Wren, which I live right across from, there's Whole Foods going in there. You know, me being a privileged white man, I still can't even go into that store every day to buy my everyday groceries. I couldn't imagine being a single mother with kids.
So what would you do about that? There's inequity about most of the food desert stuff we hear is across the river.
Correct.
But so on that, what would you do as a council member that would be...
Well, I'd be encouraging a lot more small and local businesses, like a lot of small bodegas. There's a lot of businesses up and down.
Encouraging mean grants?
So, working a lot with the Great Streets initiatives, working a lot with Georgia Avenue Thrive, District Bridges, trying to make sure that we keep those small and local businesses here in D.C. A lot of these small bodegas do have a lot of beer and cigarettes, but we need to really go with those staples.
Okay. Are there issues? Go ahead.
Talking about...
This is a little bit like speed dating.
I know, right? Unfortunately, ahead. I'm the cutest one here. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. No, a lot of it has to do with traffic.
There's two votes
lost. Right?
Go ahead.
So traffic and transportation is another huge one for me.
What would you do?
So we can't control WMATA, but we can control our streets. So putting in things like more dedicated bus lights, making sure that 16th Street project that's going on is... Keeping it simple. Right now, there's a lot of mismatch, and it seems like just a lot of missing pieces with that 16th Street bus lane project. It's going to be confusing for drivers. It's going to be confusing for a lot of other people.
And Nadeau is not doing anything on transportation in your view?
From what I've heard from ANC commissioners and people on the ground, she's quite absent.
If elected, you will not be the first, but currently the only out gay council member. Mm-hmm. There were some recent homophobic attacks in your ward, including one on U Street involving two people who I believe are friends of yours. Mm-hmm. What do you think that your being on the council, can do to address the issue of, say, violence against LGBTQ people?
I think that's something that's... it was very similar to what I was talking about, is with being direct communication with our deaf residents here in D.C. I'm someone who can be there, who can understand. As Jim Graham once has often said, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. And having that LGBTQ representation on the council is so important. The recent tax that was passed by the mayor, the elimination of feminine hygiene products by the mayor, we shouldn't be calling it feminine hygiene products. We should be calling it menstruation hygiene products, because not all women are feminine, and not all women, not all people who menstruate are men. I'm sorry, are women. Yeah, because we're talking about
Would
trans
like
individuals.
Would you like to say that again?
Yeah. Not all. Yeah, you know what I mean.
I was going to Initiative 77, but go ahead.
Very quickly today, this is actually news this morning, the Judiciary Committee passed Charles Allen to Ward 6 council member. He's the chairman of that committee. Passed campaign reform measures that if it passes the council will go into effect in 2020. That would, for the first time, outlaw corporate contributions to the mayor and to the attorney general races and limit them significantly for council races, and also would create an independent office of campaign finance, would actually make that office work, where it would have a separate office to oversee campaign finance, which is a major issue. And also in this loophole where you can give money for a mayor's inauguration, right now you can give up to $10,000. His bill would do $2,000. Those are just a few of these changes in this significant bill that was passed by the council today, Judiciary Committee. Where are you on campaign finance reform?
That's something I actually haven't even heard of. I've been preparing for this today. So I haven't been paying attention to the news this morning, unfortunately.
Well.
But I would like to look more into it, but I am
in. Are you taking a corporate donation? Nope,
absolutely not.
Okay.
Earlier this week, the D.C. Council overturned Initiative 77, which would have ended the tiered minimum wage system for tipped employees and would have raised the minimum wage for tipped employees to $15 an hour. Your opponent, Brianne Nadeau, opposed the repeal bill. Where do you fall on Initiative 77 and its repeal?
So first, I have to say, in general, I'm very cautious of any sort of initiative or any sort of voter
referendum.
Referendum. Thank you. And I bring two reasons for that. One was Proposition 8 in California. When that passed in 2008, it was heart-wrenching. And I wouldn't be able to be married to my husband and have him over here and have him have the same rights because he's an immigrant from Britain. So that's something that's really important to me. And then back in 1982, the voters overwhelmingly passed mandatory drug sentencing. And the council later overturned that in 1984. And in hindsight now, because hindsight's 2020, we realize that this is probably the best option. This was the best option.
So you would be for the repeal of Initiative 77?
So I would have wanted to get ahead of that. As soon as I would hear about that as a council member, I'd want to get ahead of that, get both parties to the table and understand really where they're coming from. Because that's what democracy is all about.
Where they're coming from is the group that wanted Initiative 77, wanted on the ballot to force the law. That wouldn't... And Silverman tried to do a compromise. Were you in favor of her compromise?
I was, but it was at the 11th hour. It wasn't enough time.
You have positions on housing that could upset some landlords, including wanting to eliminate credit checks as a qualifier for housing and making sure residents have due process before any rent increases. How do you balance a concern for renters' rights and affordable housing with, I guess you can call it, respect for the property rights of landlords?
If we have an affordable housing crisis going on right now, we need to try to mitigate that as much as possible. I want to make sure that we have landlords who do know what they're getting themselves into, but we also need to make sure that we ease a little bit of some of the ways that they can go about having a untimely or an unsatisfactory tenant as well. So I think we need to go both ways.
Landlord-tenant court is horrible. If you ever go, you just have to go for one minute to know it's not working well. Let's talk about Airbnb. It's before the council right now. Mm-hmm. The council was going to pass severe restrictions on Airbnb. Jeffrey DeWitt, the CFO for the city, said, wait a minute, you're going to cost the city $20 million a year. Airbnb collects the taxes for these various rentals. You're going to, and others have said it would interfere with people just trying to make do. Where are you on Airbnb work in the District of Columbia?
Stay out of my home. that's, if we're talking about someone's personal home, stay out.
So you agree you can ban second homes or third homes? People own two or three homes. They rent them out. Now they use them as Airbnb instead of rentals. Is that okay with you?
Correct. Yeah. So I want to make sure that if someone does have a second home, we do need to have some more restrictions on that. That's not really the issue. The primary issue that I'm hearing constantly right now since this has come up is their primary residence. If they have an accessory dwelling, they want to make sure that can be rented out as they wish. If they do have a second home,
For 90 days under the law.
Correct. And I would like to expand that a little bit more, up to 120, 180 days.
Charles Allen tried to 120.
Are we talking about the second home?
No, the private home.
Oh, private home, I don't think there should be any limit.
No limit?
No limit. I think we need to make sure that there are things like, safety protocols that are followed, C of O, certificates. Yes, those types of things need to make sure that we're there. But as far as your primary residence, stay out. Stay out of my home.
This is going to be voted on again in the next couple of weeks. It's a big issue before the council right now.
Here's Chris in Alexandria, Virginia. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just moved to Alexandria a couple of months ago from Ward 1 in the district. And I just wanted to echo what Jamie said earlier about Brianne Nadeau's lack of response to constituents. A couple of years ago, I was unemployed and I was having a really difficult time with I was briefly on unemployment from the district, and I had some difficulty with the unemployment office. And I had in the past called Jim Graham's office. And they had gotten back to me on issues regarding...
And what happened when you called Brianne Nadeau's office?
Nothing. I called twice and left, and I only got a voicemail, and no one ever got back to me.
Mm-hmm. What exactly did you want Brianne Nadeau to do? Find you a job?
No, no. I just wanted to. I was not hearing back from the unemployment office.
Oh, and you wanted to know why?
Someone said, "Yeah." So someone said, "Well, why don't you call your Ward 1 council member?"
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I said, "Well, okay. It can't hurt, right?"
That's what people do.
You know, I wasn't expecting her okay. to
respond
to,
personally.
You know, wait,
I understand, but we don't have a lot of time, so allow me to have Jamie Sycamore comment on this.
Yeah. So that's unfortunately I hear. All the time. This is the exact type of thing I'm talking about. What I really loved about Jim Graham, you know, with as many flaws as he had, is that he was always there. He wanted to be that bridge builder. If he couldn't do something for you legislatively, he was there for you to make sure that you could get connected to either district services or services outside of the government reach. And that's what I want to be. That's what I want to bring to constituent services, is be that bridge builder.
Only got about 30 seconds left.
Unemployment insurance, workers' comp, those are all serious issues beyond. Any words on DCRA?
It's a mess.
DCR is the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, for those of you unfamiliar with it.
Would you rank that as the most agency in most need of reform?
It needs a lot more attention.
Would you break it up?
I would like to see it broken up. I would like to see it broken up. I want to make sure that it's understaffed and overworked. There's a lot of responsibility given to that agency. We need to see more staffing and funding to that.
Well, Airbnb would get 20 more DCRA staffers.
Jamie Sycamore is a candidate for DC Council. He's an independent running in Ward 1. Jamie Sycamore, thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Kojo.
And that's it for today's show. The Politics Hour is produced by Mark Gunnery. Every Friday, we provide live video of the Politics Hour. We're now streaming on YouTube, where closed captioning will be available with the video after the show. Check it out at kojoshow.org and subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you're looking for plans for the weekend, our listeners contributed to a list of their favorite places to get out in nature in the Washington region, and producer Ruth Tam made a map where you can see them all. So you can check it out at kojoshow.org/blog. Tom Sherwood, what are your plans?
I might go to the National Arboretum. It's going to be great weather. Well, that's one of my places on that list that she's putting up.
Planning on checking out a Wizards game. They're back. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.